CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
Well, welcome to this afternoon's session, Time, Space and Being. We tend to think of space and time as the core structure of the universe, and it feels on a visceral level very straightforward. Yet Einstein argued that space and time are the modes by which we think, not the conditions in which we live. And it's not just scientists who've queried this. Philosophers such as Kant and Heidegger argued that space and time were the framework of our thought rather than the character of the world. So what are space and time? And could it be that space and time are a form of human fantasy? So with me to discuss this question, we've got a panel that is ideally suited to addressing such a profound issue. Michaela Massimi is a philosopher and senior lecturer at the University of Edinburgh. She would describe herself as a Kantian, and no doubt she'll provide a bigger picture of that for you today. Michaela is the co-editor-in-chief of the British Journal for the Philosophy of Science. Hugh Price is the philosopher and Bernard Russell professor at Cambridge. His many books include Facts and the Function of Truth, and Hugh is also one of the founders of the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk. That's the investigation of threats to the existence of humankind. And Julian Barber is a theoretical physicist. And remarkably, Julian has made new contributions to cosmology and to general relativity as an independent researcher. He's also author of a book called The End of Time, which you'll appreciate is entirely relevant to today's debate. So I'm going to give each of them just 4 minutes to address the question, are space and time the structure of the universe and or a framework of human thought? And then we'll have the debate in the usual fashion. So let us kick off straight away with Michaela.
The question of whether space and time are structure of our universe or not is, as you say, one of the most profound and difficult questions in the history of philosophy. St. Augustine used to say, what is time? If someone asked me, I know the answer, but if I try to explain what it is, then I don't know anymore the answer. And we can say the same about space. In a way, space is all around us. We move in space. We point at directions in space. It's the gap between my foot and the platform when I board on a train. But if I have to try to give an explanation of what space is, I find myself exactly in the same position. Going back in the history of philosophy, some of the most prominent minds that try to give answer to these questions. So back in the 1715, the German philosopher Leibniz sent a letter to the Princess of Wales accusing Newton of spreading atheism in England for defending a specific view about space and time as absolute space and time, as some empty container that exists and would exist even if no human beings, no object existed. To which Samuel Clarke, who took the defense of Newton, replied that far from spreading atheism in England, the Newton view on space and time was the best defense for the importance of God, because we can see of absolute space and time as an expression of God's presence in the world. So Newton thought that absolute space was the expression of God's omnipresence in nature, and absolute time was the expression of God's eternity. Now, that debate in different forms is still going on in contemporary philosophy of physics. We no longer talk about Newton absolute time and space, but we talk about the space-time in relativity, and no doubt the rest of the speakers will talk about that. But the debate took a turning point in the 18th century with Immanuel Kant. Kant was the first one that, in my view, clearly distinguished two different questions. One is the question of how we come to know about space and time. How is it that our knowledge of the world seems to be spatiotemporal? So we know that objects are in space and time. That's a question about our knowledge. That's a different question from the metaphysical question about, are space and time real? How should we think of space and time? Kant gave different answers to these different questions. So on the first question, on the question of how we come to know about space and time, he defended an a prioristic view. So against the empiricists from Berkeley to, in a way, to Leibniz, he defended the view that space and time are a priori forms of intuitions through which we come to know the world as in space and time. So the metaphysical question, he gave a related but distinct answer in terms of the ideality of space and time, and he used different kinds of arguments. So he has all sets of arguments against Newton, absolute time and absolute space, including one that resorts to a charge of Spinozism, which is not a very well-known argument. It's an argument that he has in the Critique of Practical Reason, not the Pure Reason, where he basically says, well, if Newton is right, if really space and times are determinations of God's substance, then our freedom is jeopardized. We're just automata moving and acting in an absolute space and time. So we should keep those two questions distinct, because in my view, the answer that Kant gave to the first question about how we come to know the world as spatiotemporal is still very valid, and it's an answer that some studies in contemporary neuroscience, studies on rats and how higher vertebrates learn how to know the world as spatiotemporal, seems to vindicate loosely some Kantian intuition about space and times, whereas the question about the metaphysics and answer in terms of ideality, I think it's a question that should be left to contemporary physicists and cosmologists to answer.
There's a particular problem about thinking about the question as to whether time is real at the moment, which is comes from the fact that the word time has become ambiguous in contemporary debates. And if we're not careful to note the ambiguity, it can turn out that we're simply talking past each other in trying to address the question as to whether time is real. So I want to start off by distinguishing two conceptions of time so that we have that clearly on the table in front of us. On the one hand, you could call it the ordinary conception of time, the ordinary human conception of time, and we can distinguish a number of elements to that. One is the idea that the present moment is somehow particularly special. People often say that the present exists, the past and the future don't. The future doesn't yet exist, the past no longer exists. Another aspect of this ordinary conception is that the idea of the flow or passage of time, there seems to be something essentially dynamic about time. And another third element of it, which is again subtly different, I think, is the idea that there's some fundamental sense in which the future is different from the past. So those are all elements of what we might call our ordinary human conception of time. And then in physics, we get a conception of time which is very different from that, in that, at least in the view of most physicists, Julian can tell me if I'm wrong, there's no place for any of those three elements in the picture that physics gives us of time. So there's no privileged present moment, there's nothing like a real dynamic flow of time, and there's no deep, at the deep level anyway, there's no deep distinction between the past and the future. Now, but what that means is that if two people are having a discussion about whether time is real or not, they may be talking about different things. Because one of them may be defending the reality of time in the second sense, in the physicist sense, and the other may be attacking it in the ordinary sense. And those two things are, of course, perfectly compatible. So what's happened is we've reached one of those episodes in the history of science or the history of thought where we just have to decide how we want to use a term. It doesn't really matter which way we go. We could invent a new word for the new physicist conception of time. Another example where this has happened is the word atom. I mean, as it was originally introduced by the Greeks, it meant something indivisible. But nobody these days thinks that atoms are indivisible. So at some point we had a choice point. We had a choice about whether to continue using the term atom for the small things which were playing a role in 19th and early 20th century physics. As it turned out, we went on calling them atoms even though they weren't divisible. And we have a similar choice in the case of time. So when we're talking today about whether time is real, we need to be very careful about which kind of time we're talking about, whether we're talking about the time of ordinary experience, which has a distinguished present moment, a sense of flow, and a difference between the past and future, or whether we're talking about time in the physicist's sense, which doesn't have any of those things.
Well, I totally agree with Hugh on the importance of asking exactly what concept of time and space we're talking about. I'm going to talk about what seems to me essential for doing physics, and I'm going to go back to how Michaela started with this famous correspondence between Leibniz and Clark, who was representing Newton. Now, Newton's idea of absolute space, I think, really is very intuitive. It comes from the fact that human beings developed on a basically stable Earth, and in this room here we have walls that are not moving relative to each other. We can position things relative to the walls of this room and we know what we're talking about. So that's very nice and stable. And somehow or other you get the impression that space is there, as it were, like an invisible block of ice. And that, I think, is a fair characterization of how Newton thought about absolute space. He had very good reasons why he thought that way. Now, Leibniz said, no, it's not that. He said, space is the order of coexisting things. And it's very nice. He said that in one of the letters. And Clark wrote back, clearly prompted by Newton, saying, what do you mean by order? And the next letter Leibniz wrote, he didn't answer that question. So that letter from Clark then says, you haven't answered my question. What do you mean by order? And then Leibniz comes clean. He says, I imagine there are bodies in the universe, and by order I mean the distances between the bodies. So if I have here three bodies in the universe, I mean the distances between them, and that's all there is. You mustn't think there's a space in which they're embedded. It's just the distances between them. That's the only reality. And that's what space is. It's the distances between the things. Now, I would say that I would change that and say that Leibniz was on the right track, but it's something different. I would say that space, to the extent you can talk about it meaningfully, is the order of coexisting facts. Now, let me say what I mean by that. And this is something actually that the ancient Egyptians, the surveyors, actually really stumbled upon, because the ancient Egyptians knew about Pythagoras' theorem 4,000 years ago. So if you drive stakes into the ground and then you take measuring rods, bamboo canes or ropes, which you can pick up just like that thanks to nature. So here are my stakes and I can measure the distances between all of these things. So if there's 50 points there, there's essentially 50 times 49 divided by 2 distances that you can measure there. And that's something empirical. You get facts. You get your measuring rod and you find out what those things are. Those are facts. And then if a clever mathematician looks at him, he finds something very remarkable. If there are five or more points between which you've measured those distances, you find they satisfy algebraic relations. Certain combinations of those distances, you square them and you take square roots and things like that, you get something absolutely magical. Particular combination of them is equal to zero. And this tells you you've discovered some very profound order in it. And it is that order, which I believe is really the only thing that is real about space. I can move this thing around and it doesn't change those separations between it. And actually the overall size means nothing. Everything is actually expressed ultimately in terms of angles. So those original measurements that the Egyptian surveyors make are the facts, and it's the order, the relationships between the facts, which tell us that space is there. And once you've got that, what is wonderful, the mathematician can then place these points in an imaginary space and register them there. And then you can imagine moving them around like that. But actually the facts are completely unchanged. So you wouldn't think, you shouldn't think there's a real space in which I'm moving this. The reality is just those relationships. And if you read the opening page of Piaget's account about how children learn about space, it is actually much the same. He's saying it's not nearly as easy as that.
The debate. Theme one.
You had a very clear account there of that space is not something that exists, that you want to say exists in reality. I'd like to push the two philosophers here to say what they think space is. Michaela, you gave us a historical description and Kant's account, but are you wanting to say that space and time are forms of thought and aren't reality?
Right. I guess the question of whether I'm going to concentrate on space, I'm sure time is going to be covered by Hugh, but let's focus on space. When we ask the question of whether space is real, we need to distinguish different meaning of what we mean by real. If by real we mean a space, some kind of substance in the way in which Newton thought the space was, then we're going to end up exactly with the debate that Julian was referring to. Debates that are still ongoing in contemporary physics and philosophy of physics about whether we should think of space as some sort of substance, or we should think of space as a bundle of relations. Obviously, we are no longer working within the framework of Newtonian mechanics, so we're not talking about Newton absolute time and space, but we're talking about the space-time of general relativity and how can one be a relationalist in contemporary debates about space. So that's a debate for the physicist. But there is another sense of being real, which has to do with, I suppose, what you was referring to as our ordinary intuitions of the world as spatiotemporal, or what Kant would say our experience of the world as spatiotemporal. So real can mean mind independent. So if you're asking me, is space real? You're asking me, is space mind independent? And so a Kantian response would be to say, well, no, in a way, it cannot be totally mind-independent, because Kant would say it's an a priori forms of intuition. Studies by the 2014 Nobel Prize winner John O'Keefe and his colleagues over the past decades on the hippocampus have shown how we are born, in a way, hardwired to perceive the world as a three-dimensional Euclidean space. So from very early ages, our hippocampus developed a very sophisticated system of cell differentiation that allows us to find directions in space, identify boundaries, distances in space. So, for example, according to John O'Keefe and colleagues, that seems to vindicate some loosely Kantian view that, in a way, we are born hardwired to perceive the world as in space.
But summary of a go at Kantian. We have to see the world in terms of space and time, or have to perceive the world in space and time, but it's not somehow out there in an independent reality. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so I'm saying that those are different questions, exactly. One is a metaphysical question about the metaphysics of space and time.
Do you think that out there, there isn't space, in this independent reality, that out
no,
there,
I'm not saying
there isn't space and time?
No. What I'm saying is that one is a metaphysical question about...
No, I understood it. One's a metaphysical question.
And that's a metaphysical question within...
I understood that, but I want to push you and say, well, where are you going to come down? What are you saying about the metaphysical question of what's out there?
Oh, that's a question that I'm going to leave to Julia.
I would say that
one of the typical problems with the Kantian view is that very often people have been reading Kant and the epistemological question as a question that is tantamount to a metaphysical question, which is legitimate because that's the way Kant, presented his view. So obviously his view is a form of idealism about space and time. What I want to suggest, and this is really my take on Kant, is that we should distinguish between Kant's contribution to the epistemology of space and times from Kant's own view about the metaphysics of space and time. I wouldn't buy into Kant's idealism, but I think that there is still a kernel of truth in his account of how we come to know the world as spatiotemporal. And but the first question is a question really not even for metaphysician, but for physicists.
But my question to you is, if you don't buy into Kant's idealism, which somehow we can't say anything about that's out there, what do you think about space and time out there?
I think that they are...
And when you say you point to Julian, presumably there are other physicists who will have different views Julian about space and time. do you just point to all of these physicists and say, well, I don't have any view about what there is out there, I'm just going to leave it to the physicists to decide?
I'm going to say that I'm interested in the epistemological question. So one of the reasons why I'm attracted to the Kant position is because I'm interested in the question of how we come to know the world as in space and time. And the metaphysical question is a very profound question, but it's a question that I think will be better left to whatever the...
Okay. And from an epistemological point of view, we've got no choice. We have to think of the world in terms of space and time.
Well, that's what I would say, yes.
Okay.
Just a very quick one, if I may. Just in those, your point about us being hardwired and the experiments, the man who got the Nobel Prize...
Well, that's not exactly the way Kant would put it.
Or the man who got the Nobel Prize very recently for the rats having this picture of there, and that it was Kantian. I just would like to know, and I don't suppose the experiment was done, these fish that live in shoals and are never on solid ground, whether they... whether they're hardwired in the same way that rats are. I think that's an interesting question, because actually, if you stop and think about it, there are no stable walls for those fishes there, particularly if they're out in the mid-ocean and all they're doing is feeding on plankton and things like that. There may not be anything like, or the ones halfway down to the bottom of the ocean. So I think that's an interesting question. I just wanted to interject that.
Theme two.
So Hugh, where do you stand on this? I mean, is space and time... out there real or not?
Well, Hilary, you probably know the philosophy version of the light bulb joke, which was, how many philosophers does it take to change a light bulb? Well, it depends on what you mean by change. philosophers have this annoying habit of not taking the words at face value, and that's what I want to do to you.
Was in return trying to... you clarified the meaning of the words, but the way you wanted to use them in terms of the present and the river, but within that, what do you then want to say about whether space and time are independent of us?
I'll come to the independent of us question, but first of all, I just want to start by saying that one of the things I wanted to say about space, as I said at the beginning, is that we have to be very careful that we're not dealing with an ambiguity. And as we look at the trajectory from our ordinary conception of space, what, as Julian says, we may have because we tend to live in environments with solid objects, things like walls in them, if we move from that to the kind of picture of space that Julian was offering us in this done in these elegant mathematical terms, we can, if we want, continue using the term space, but we have to recognize that we've also got the option to simply talk to invent a different word and say, we've given up on that one. We've decided to use this one instead. So we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that there's a single thing whose essence we're trying to understand all along. So that's one I wanted to say about space, as I said it about time. Now, coming to the question of reality of what's out there, I think we have to have a similar caution about that kind of metaphor of things being either out there or not. I mean, one way to think about it is in terms of the notion of the world. I think the notion of the world is a notion that does a lot of harm in philosophy because people don't reflect on it enough. Here's one thing that you might mean by out there. You might mean the question as to whether something is true or not is in some sense independent of us. So the question as to whether it's noisy in here is independent of us. It's just at the moment, it's not. There's a fact about that. But it's a fact to understand which we have to think about the fact that humans have ears and so on. So there's a kind of human ingredient in it. Similar if we talk about colors. Now, that's not a sharp divide that we can put things on one side or the other. It's a continuum. And I want to say that when we're asking when we're asking in blunt terms the question, is something really out there, we're making the mistake of thinking of that as a sharp bifurcation, where it's really a continuum. And what we can say, I think, is that the kinds of notions used in advanced science, or the kind of picture of space that Julian was giving us, is a lot less infected with distinctively human ways of thinking than talking of noise or colour or smells. And that's a kind of clarification which has been going on for centuries, at least since the 17th century. And it's what the 20th century philosopher, great American philosopher Wilfred Sellers, called the distinction between the manifest image, the ordinary sort of picture of the world we have, and the scientific image. But there's no reason to think of that as a sharp line. And that's the respect in which I was objecting to the way in which you were putting that question.
So is there anything that you would want to say with those caveats about you had two descriptions of time you gave us to start with, time as the present and time as the river. With your caveat about a sharp distinction between the real and not real, what would you want to say with those about the existence or not of, say, the time as a river?
I would want to say that the time as a river thing is much more part of what Sellers called the manifest image. So it involves our ordinary human ways of thinking about time much more than the scientific picture does.
So does that mean you don't think that there is a river of time there's no direction of time out there, as it were?
No, so this is where I want to resist the sharp division between what's out there and what's not. Because I don't want to end up in the position of denying the ordinary sorts of things that we say, like we say, it's now Friday afternoon. That's perfectly true. Well, I didn't make that up. We can say that's a fact. It's Friday afternoon. But that involves a reference to what time it is now, which is something that we can only say because we are kind of creatures who are embedded in time in a particular way. So one of the characteristics of this, what I was trying to portray as a kind of gradual gradation from the more human-centric concepts at one end to the more scientific concepts at the other, is that at the subjective end, the human-centric end, we have concepts whose use depends on various kinds of contingencies about us, on the fact that we have locations in space and time, things of that kind. Or, as Julian says, that the fact that we happen to live in environments with fixed, or what seem to us as fixed physical objects in them. Whereas the scientific view of the world is a view which depends on fewer and fewer of those contingencies. But it's basically a continuum.
And do you want to privilege one of those?
No, not at all.
Are all of these just alternative ways of talking about it?
They're not alternatives in the sense that you have to choose one or the other. Hmm? They're different ways of speaking, and if you're interested in the scientific project of finding a way of speaking which sort of detaches itself from the contingencies of our viewpoint, then you should learn to speak in the scientific way.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to iai.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news, and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Theme 3.
So, Julian, do you think there's anything privileged about the scientific picture of space and time?
I think science is a phenomenal success. There was a very good lecture in Oxford recently by Paul Nurse, the present president of the Royal Society, where he's saying, I mean, it started with long ago, before the agricultural revolution, with metallurgy and things like that. As regards sort of trying to understand what the world is, I think Hugh is right where he, I mean, I think it was very good where Hugh was talking about the different meanings of atoms, how the meaning of the word atom has changed. And I think if we really want to try and understand what this extraordinary universe really is like, we just have to look at what is the best current picture that science is giving us, and recognize that it's changing all the time. Can I come in now to talk about time, how I think about it? Now, Leibniz, I think on one thing, I believe Leibniz was right, basically at the most basic level on time. So he as space, he said space is the order of coexisting things, and I replace that by space is the order of coexisting facts. And Leibniz said, time is just the succession of coexisting things, and I would say the succession of coexisting facts. And it's very easy to see what he meant by that. If I have a universe which just consists of three particles, I can imagine that in one instant of time they look like that. And I want you only to think of the shape that counts, just the shape. The two angles determine the shape of those three particles there. That's one there. And then I may be given, I give one to Hugh, then I give him the next one, and it's a different shape. But I could give you all intermediate ones that go continuously one into the other. And just by the successive shapes, I could order them in an order just using the information in the successive shapes. What I can't do is put a direction onto it. Nothing in that we know in physics actually puts a direction on and says which one goes in which order. But I think for me, the Leibniz is spot on that you can really think of the universe as just being successive shapes, one after another, like that. And in fact, if I were to throw them down in a confused heap there and shuffle them all, nothing is lost. The information is there. It's just like cutting up a movie into individual stills. I can put them back in the right order. And if it's a proper movie telling a proper story that we're familiar with, there will be a one direction in which you play it. We've all seen these reversed films where people come out of swimming pools backwards. The film was taken as they dive in, and then you just run the film backwards. But there is this is the problem of the origin of the arrow of time. And I don't know whether I'm not going to give my talk that I gave at 1 o'clock in the ring. But I think one can begin to understand that. But now, I would say, I think there is a notion of now. It is just, so to speak, that the universe is like this now. That is our now. But the universe is now different, and this is our now. I don't see... Einstein said he was terribly... The reason why Einstein was worried about there's no place for now was because he denied a notion of simultaneity. But I think there is a representation of Einstein's theory where you restore a notion of simultaneity, but you take out size and you only look at shapes. So I think it will be possible to talk about now. And I think Einstein's great concern about there being no place for now in the modern worldview is just mistaken. It's always... We are in a particular now, and it's constantly different. It's a wonderful world.
I just want to take Julian up on the last point there, because I want to put the now towards the more human-centric end rather than towards the more scientific end. The way I like to make the point is to say, look, Julian, if I asked you to tell me what you did last week or what the universe was like last week, then in terms of your picture, you'd show me the diagrams that represented the temporal stages of all of the days of last week. You haven't left anything out if you haven't pointed to any one of those diagrams as representing the now. Indeed, if I said to you, well, you've told me all about last week, but you haven't said which of those days was now. Obviously, the only answer you can give is, well, each of them was now when
yes.
It happened.
Oh, absolutely. Each the world, the space. Who was it used this lovely expression, the space of possibilities? Was it you this morning? No, somebody used the space of possibilities. Perhaps it was George Ellis. The space of possibilities is all possible nows, and we're lucky enough to be in one of them. And it's damned marvellous, frankly, to see you all here listening wonderfully, and Hilary smiling. That is the space of all possibilities. It's all possible nows, and we're in one. And as one other thing is this accumulation, that the nows are very wonderful, because in some senses what is inside my brain is not only this picture, but there's also pictures of these other nows that we think were in the past. So they're all there at once in some senses. Okay. This is why I know what Hugh looks like.
Let me have one more. I've just picked up two of these frames at random, these frames from a movie, as you said. Now, we want this to think of this as a complete movie, so we want you to be in the movie, not outside it.
Yes.
Which of these frames are you in?
I'm in both.
Exactly. So neither is privileged from your point of view. Each one is privileged from the point of view of the particular version of you which is in that one. But that's true of the version of you which is in that one as well.
I'm the biggest egoist. I'm interested in me now. If I no, I mean, well, perhaps. Well, precisely.
But when you look at the description of the universe, there's no one of those frames is picked out. It's only.
No, well, this is the gorgeous thing. There are many Julians, and there are all of us. There are many of us. They're all the experiences. They're all the moments in which we've lived.
Yes,
I mean, what a cornucopia of riches.
I know, but in that sense, there are many nows, and no single now is picked out from the point of view of the
universe. Well, I would say this is very encouraging. I mean, maybe we are, this is dangerous, but are we perhaps even beginning to move into the divine, where each of our instants is part of the totality of everything, is one manifestation of everything?
I just be inclined to say no.
Michaela, how do we separate the business of the frames of thought, or in the Kantian description, the forms of intuition, and what Julian is trying to do, which is describe what space and time are in the independent sense of the physical character of the universe? How do we separate these? You had two versions, you know, the wanting to separate the personal, as it were, from the scientific account.
I insisted that it shouldn't be seen as a sharp separation. It should be seen as more of a gradation.
So how do we tease these out? How much of Julian's account there do you think is in the on the frames of thought bit, and how much of it do you think is to do with what's going on? I don't know how to refer to it since you've cautioned me on describing it as out there.
Well, I would say that what Julian was illustrating by using these to illustrate the idea of the kind of description which his version of physics would give us of spatial relations and so on, that's pretty much as far at the opposite end of the spectrum from the human-centric stuff as it's at this stage possible for us to be. But then when he wanted to put the now into it, I thought he was confusing that with something which I would want to regard as being very much at the opposite end of the spectrum.
Okay. Maybe just try.
I would also say, yeah. I mean, now and here are indexicals. So the very moment in which we talk about the now and the here, we're talking about Julian now, here, in this room, talking to all of us. And it seems to me that, going back to your question, this is the Kantian, humocentric, if you want, point of view, that whenever we talk about space and times, we have to position ourselves in space and times. Now and here are privileged indexicals through which, with our language, we do that all the time. And our ability also, I wanted to respond to Julian about the example of the mollusk on the shell. The difference between that and rats and us is that we have an ability to navigate around the world. So I take that some of those neuroscientific research about spatial memories have a lot to do with the way we think about space and times, not as the physicists think of them, as some sort of a frame of reference, however you want to understand the frame of reference in terms of an empty container, bunch of relation, but they've got to do with our ability of locate ourselves in space and time, here, now, and navigate in space and time. So my ability to catch the train to come down from Edinburgh to A-on-Y, my ability to discern north, south, east, and west, my ability to move in space and time. So that's my response to that here and now.
Maybe a way of trying to get a better handle of what we're trying to say here, we got to ask some sort of lateral questions. One would be, can we imagine something outside of space and time? Do you think we can imagine anything outside of space and is there an outside of space and time?
Well, Kant said we can think of empty space, but we cannot represent the absence of space. The way we represent the world is in space and time.
So there's no, I mean, would you both agree with that? Is there no outside? It's not possible to somehow stand outside and...
Well, once again, I'm going to do this annoying thing of asking for some clarification of the term outside. I mean, there's one way we can take the term outside where it sounds like a spatial term. Outside means in some other region of space other than the one we're talking about. In that sense, of course, no, nothing can be outside space. It's a contradiction.
You could maybe have a conceptual sense of outside, conceptual space.
Exactly. So you might have a conception of things which were real but which were not spatio-temporal.
Yes.
So you might think that, I mean, many people have thought that mathematics lives in some other realm, which is not a spatial realm.
Do you think there is an alternative realm, which is not one which falls within a framework? Can we think in a way which is not within a spatio-temporal framework?
I certainly think we can think of things which are not spatio-temporal, and I would give numbers as an example. Now, my own view is it's not the traditional Platonic view that numbers exist in Plato's heaven. That seems to me to have too much of the sort of residue among other things, of a quasi-spatial picture. You're thinking of the numbers having to exist in some sense somewhere, although it's not, strictly speaking, in space. I'd rather take a much more relaxed view and think about how we come to talk that way and tie it in with my relaxed view about the gradation between the subjective or human-centric stuff on the other, on one hand, and the more or less objective stuff on the other, and say yes, numbers are a perfectly good example of something that we talk about which is not in space. And I would say that the value is another thing that we talk about.
So we can think the idea, can we, of something that's not temporal?
Yes, certainly we can. I mean, roughly speaking, the only kinds of things that have to exist in space and time are sort of physical matter, things of that kind. But lots of things that we talk about are not of that kind.
Yeah. Would you go along with that?
I probably don't have the sophisticated view of numbers that you was referring to. So I wouldn't really know how to think of even mathematical entities in those lines. I find it a hard time to think of something that exists outside.
Can I sort of slightly change subject and come... Well, this sounds awfully egocentric, but I'd like to challenge the existence of whether Julian exists and in what sense he does. The fact of the matter is, if you looked at me microscopically, I'm different. I change billions of times between 1 second and the next. I mean, the hemoglobin... Read Richard Dawkins' account of the hemoglobin molecule, how it changes, how many are made and destroyed in a split second in our body. It's just, and in my book, The End of Time, I talk about our cat. It was phenomenal. It could leap 6 feet in the air and catch swifts in flight. And I have the sentence, the cat that leapt is not the cat that landed. And come back to Leibniz. Leibniz has a fantastic vision of the world, which I think for me is about the best I like. First of all, he makes the statement, which I don't think is tenable, which all fundamental entities in the world are sentient beings, and he calls them monads. And he says all monads are just different views of the universe, views of the same universe from a different point of view. And I go along, I think for me this is still about the best way of thinking about the universe. We, each of us in experiencing things, we are part of the universe, and everything about us is just part. And to some extent, I think it's very true, we, in the truest sense, we are just part of the universe. I don't, And I don't believe in myself as an autonomous person. I find this very striking when I'm giving a talk. Very often I have not the remotest idea what word is going to come out of my mouth in 2 seconds' time. And a lot of that is determined by the reaction from the audience, or something I suddenly recall from an earlier discussion with Hugh at breakfast or something like that. I'm to be quite honest, I'm not in charge of myself. I am a manifestation of the universe. And the poets have always said they don't create their poems, they're just conduits that comes out.
Of course, you have the strangeness that as just a bit of the universe, you have tried to provide a description of it in the description you've just given us. So you have this sort of little bit of self-reference in the universe, like you're the standing back, there would just be this one bit which somehow be mapped onto everything else in some way, which is rather
well, the self-reference, of course,
idea
is very difficult.
Why that would be.
But Leibniz has a lovely, it's wrong. I'm being hugely megalomaniac. I'm saying I am the entire universe, but Leibniz has this wonderful picture of when you're at some distance from the sea, you hear the confused noise of the waves breaking on the shore. And so the real, all the details are at a level where you can't pick it up easily. You can only pick up some things close to you, so that it's that confused noise. But Leibniz makes the claim, we are literally the whole universe. And I think there may well be a case for that. The fact that if you go back and say, what is the information that is actually determining our universe, which solution of Einstein's equations we live in, actually that predetermines, or quantum mechanics, to a large degree determines what we are. So that's there. Let me also end with another lovely story. Ernst Mach, who's a great hero of mine, who gave his name to the Mach numbers, he said, I am utterly different from what I was a child. And he tells a lovely story after he had a stroke, and he got into a train in Vienna, and at the opposite end of the carriage, down the aisle, he saw an old man getting in at the other end, and he said, what a decrepit old academic that is. And then he realized there was a mirror down there, and he was looking at himself. So it's just utterly changed. I'm completely changed from me as a baby. But I would say in each case, in some real sense, we were the total universe.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. If you enjoyed this debate and want to carry on the discussion, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.